501c3 entity for your contributions are tax deductible. We would like everyone to mute your microphone, and this meeting is recorded, which I just got that mouse in my ear and I was distracted. I have an abbreviated introduction this morning because our meeting has a full agenda as we recognize our scholarship award recipients. Since formation, FFPC has raised more than $450,000 in scholarships that are awarded annually to Iowa high school seniors who have done significant things to reduce homophobia and educate about LGBTQ issues in schools and communities. Please visit our website, ffbciowa.org, to make a donation, read newsletters, hear past speakers, and so much more. So we would also ask questions to be held towards at the end of the speaker and not make it interactive because it would be too disruptive with the number of people. You can post in the chat during the presentation and that can be addressed at the end. We do need to limit questions to allow more time for the scholarship award presentation. So Tim McMillan, please make the introduction.
Actually, Byron, this is Michael Egon.
Mike, you're doing it? Okay. Well, then. Sorry, Michael. I thought Tim told me he was doing it. And I didn't see him on the call, but okay. Mike, go ahead.
Thank you, Byron. It's my pleasure to introduce this morning's speaker, who I'm looking forward to meeting actually in person here in just a couple of weeks, actually at Hoyt Sherman Place, as we prepare to present his remarkable opera, Fellow Travelers, on July 17th. In that beautiful newly renovated space. Kevin Newberry is a theater, opera, and film director. He tells me that he's in Cincinnati this morning, working on a project there at Cincinnati Opera. He is based in New York City, and his work as a director and theater, opera, and film director focuses on issues of community, empathy, social justice, and with a particular focus on shared LGBTQAI history. He's directed over 80 original productions, all around 70 original productions, I'm sorry, all around the world in major theaters and opera companies, including the Park Avenue Armory, Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., Brooklyn Academy of Music, Barcelona, San Francisco Opera, Lyric Opera of Chicago, American Repertory Theater, Houston Grand Opera, Santa Fe Opera, St. Louis, Minnesota, Montreal, Philadelphia, St. Louis. It goes on and on. Particular interest to our audience is the 2016 world premiere of a work that he originated in conjunction with composer Greg Spears, librettist Greg Pierce, and the novelist Thomas Malone, called Fellow Travelers, which is a remarkable new work. I had a chance to see it at the Lyric Opera of Chicago a few seasons ago and knew immediately that we needed to bring this to Des Moines as quickly as possible. We had originally scheduled it for last summer, of course, and with COVID, we're able to push it forward to this season. It will be presented in its original production with a marvelous cast that one night only, few tickets remain. And I will say that for me, the idea of hearing, for me as a gay male, hearing our stories sung, hearing words that all of us have probably heard in the course of our lives said to us or communicated to us, but sung on the stage, provided such a powerful, cathartic, and beautiful moment for me personally, and I hope it will for you too. But the broader idea of learning about a chapter in our history, the Lavender Scare, in which LGBTQ individuals were rooted out and removed from public service, had careers destroyed, lives destroyed, et cetera, was something that I did not know about and that this piece taught me about, had that educational component to it as well. And for that, I was grateful and extremely moved. And I know and hope that you will be too if you see this presentation. Without further ado, I will turn it over to Kevin, who will tell us a little bit about how about his journey to this piece and the piece in itself and what it means for our community.
Well, thank you, Michael, for that generous introduction. And I'm so honored to meet you all, and congrats to the scholarship winners. So my name is Kevin. My pronouns are he, him, his. And yes, as Michael said, I have devoted much of my life and work and career to telling our stories. And this particular opera completely changed my life. It first came into my life through my Sterling Zinsmeyer, who are Alan called Fellow Travelers. And I read it and he said, it must be an opera. We have to turn it into an opera. And when I read it, I didn't know very much about the Lavender Scare either. It was brand new to me. And this book, Tom's book, is what really taught me about this chapter in our history. Just by a show of hands, how many of you knew anything or know anything about the Lavender Scare, kind of read about it a little bit? Great. I'm glad to see that some of you have been exposed. And this opera and this novel have been a big part of that journey. And of course, there's been some documentaries that have come out as well recently. But there are so many chapters in our history that are left out. I mean, I find that the generation behind me doesn't even know about the AIDS crisis and what actually the generation ahead of me went through. And I'm 43, by the way, so I'm right in between the two generations, of the generations that lived through that crisis and the younger generation that is just now in many ways learning about it. So I feel like it's my duty to be a bridge among generations. I believe very strongly that we stand on the shoulders of those that came before us in our community. And this piece, it changed my life. And so when Sterling called me, I said, you're absolutely right. This would be a great opera. And we set about to find our writing team and the composer, Gregory Spears, who's actually in the hotel across the hall from me right now, because we're here working on our next piece in Cincinnati, and the librettist, Greg Pierce. And we developed this piece and told the story that we wanted to tell. And Tom Mallon gave us the permission to really run with it. And then we brought it here to Cincinnati Opera. The serendipity that I'm actually here right now working on our next piece as my dear associate Marcus Shields is remounting Fellow Travelers in Des Moines is actually quite moving, that we're all here together. It feels very full circle. And just to give you a very, very brief overview of the Lavender Scare, I'm not really an historian or a scholar on the subject, but the fact that the government used the kind of Red Scare and the idea of communism to root out all the gays in government is just something that most people don't know a lot about. So it really started with Eisenhower's edict. It was 1050 in 1953 that said it was illegal to be gay and work in the government. And so everybody was, of course, very closeted. And Roy Cohn, who is really probably the most evil figure in our queer culture and history in the 20th century, not only, I mean, you know, how many of you know Angels in America? I'm sure many of you have seen Angels in America, know it. And Roy Cohn famously said that he wasn't gay. He just liked to sleep with men, right? He was a straight person who slept with men, but he was not a homosexual. And that kind of self-hating queer culture really did so much damage, not only in the 50s during the Lavender Scare, but of course during the AIDS crisis, and not to mention Roy Cohn and his political leanings and all of the fallout from that. So it's estimated that between around 3,000 to 4,000 people lost their jobs. And the main idea behind it for the for McCarthy and Roy Cohn, who was his lawyer, and the whole committee to get rid of the gays in government, was that they thought that they were liable to be blackmailed, right? So that if you were gay, then the communists and the Russians would threaten to out you, and then you would keep their secrets and help with their espionage or somehow convert to the Communist Party and further their cause. So that was the justification. As far as I know, they never found any instance of somebody in the queer community being blackmailed by the Russians and somehow furthering the communist mission. So it was all a ruse. So many people lost their jobs. So many people took their own lives, and complete careers were absolutely ruined. And we can trace this throughout the history of our country, of course, down to the ban of you know, queer people in government and all the way to the military. Course, in the 80s and 90s, this kind of systematic exclusion and punishment for being who we are in our own government is just, these stories are so important to tell. And as we were putting together the opera, and again, I'm so proud that this opera is traveling around the country and going to communities that really, really, I think, can benefit from it. I've seen it change people's lives. I'm going to start getting really emotional talking to you all today. Really, it's really special to be here with you. I've actually seen it happen. I see people come into the opera and they're nervous sometimes, right? Especially from our straight, you know, community members. And you see them shifting in their chair a little bit. And then by the end of the opera, they're in tears and they care about these characters. And I've heard audience members say, you know, it really hurt my feelings when Hawk turned Tim in, and they start to root for this couple. I've seen people come out to their families and loved ones in the lobby after the show. Every time we do it, people don't want to leave. We have to actually ask people to leave the lobby because we have to, you know, whoever the theater has to get on with their business, and the conversations continue. So, you know, I really do believe that art and theater and opera and film and everything that I've dedicated my life to, that it can actually change lives. In addition to the work that you're all doing in your community and your schools to teach people about this history. And I think one of the things that was really important for us too, is that the love scenes were real, that they were intimate, that it felt not just sexy for its own sake, but that it was really not shying away from what we do in bed, right? I mean, it's not that it's X-rated or anything, of course, but I hope you agree when you see it, that these love scenes are, they're very, very intimate. And you really, really believe that these two men, I mean, the basic story of Fellow Travelers, it's an older man who works for the State Department named Hawk, and he falls for this young neophyte in Washington named Timmy. And eventually, I don't know if I should spoil the ending for you. Maybe I should not, so you can be surprised if you're coming to see it. But things don't go so well because of their secret relationship. And that it was such a time of terror. And I've spoken to several people that worked in Washington during that time period. And if you went to a gay bar, this happened all the way till Stonewall, you were liable to be blackmailed and you could lose your job in 1 second. There was so much finger pointing, and it was such a homophobic culture. And this continued for, you know, for years, of course, until McCarthy was finally, when it was finally, you know, over, you know, and it was, and J. Edgar Hoover was a big part of it. And so we were really trying to balance the politics of the time period with the love story. So Greg Pierce and I knew from the beginning that we wanted to make Fellow Travelers a love story. The novel is a love story as well. How many of you have read the novel? Anyone on the, I highly recommend it. And it kind of vacillates between the more political content and the more intimate content of the love story. And we wanted to weave those things together. And I'm glad that you said, Michael, that hopefully this opera educates and teaches you a bit about the Lavender Scare, but it's not a polemic. It doesn't feel like a kind of a history lesson. It's an intimate story. A very ensemble-based story. So one of the things to look for in the production is that there's always people kind of lurking in the shadows. So in our cast of nine, I think you have a couple more actually in Des Moines, everything orbits around these two lovers, and there's always people in the shadows. There's always this sense of danger. Even when they think that they're alone, at any moment, someone can come in and take their whole world away from them. And I think the moment in the opera that that gets me every time, I'm just going to give you a little bit of insight. I'm not spoiling the ending. I'm just going to tell you one of the penultimate things that happens. And so after, you know, Timmy is run out of town for being turned in, for being gay, there's a moment where all the characters come and surround him and they turn their back on him one at a time. And set to Gregory's score, I just burst into tears. And I think that I've also found that, and also our straight allies burst into tears, but especially people in our community, those of us that share this history, we all know what that feels like to have grown up and had this secret or have come out and had, you know, different responses that maybe weren't as positive as we would have liked. I mean, my God, the idea of me coming out when I was growing up in the 1980s in Maine, I mean, that wouldn't have survived. Of course, things have changed thanks to so much of the work that we're all collectively doing. And so that moment, also look out for Mary Johnson. She is a kind of composite character based on someone that Tom Mallon really knew, because we did have some allies. It's not that everybody was out to get us. And she was Mary Johnson has become sort of a catchphrase in our tribe here in the opera. Cause like, if you're a Mary Johnson, you're an ally, right? And she's the one person that doesn't turn her back on him at the end. And, you know, one of the big Bibles for me right now is the Faggots and Their Friends Between Revolutions. Has anyone come across that book yet? Oh, you're in for such a treat. It's not about the lavender scare, but I wish I had it with me. I would hold it up as a prop if I were in my office, but it started out as a pamphlet by Larry Mitchell that was kind of passed around San Francisco in the late 70s. And it's all about our shared community and our tribe and sexuality and intimacy. And it just got published for the first time in 2019. And has amazing illustrations in it. I go and order it immediately. I think you'll find it to be really, really inspiring. So anyway, that's a little bit about the opera and about the Lavender Scare. And it's interesting when we were here in Cincinnati, you know, Cincinnati is the town, of course, that, you know, ran out Robert Mapplethorpe posthumously. I mean, this is where the Perfect Moment exhibit opened for, and everything, all the fallout for the kind of explicit gay content. And one of this should stay between us, even though we're recording it. But when we first opened it, there was a moment, oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't tell this story, but in the spirit of candor, where the company was nervous about how people would respond. And there was a moment when the administration said, we're going to put a warning sign out that says this opera contains intimate scenes between two men. And that's how far we've come, right? And of course we said, you cannot put that sign out there. You can say this opera contains adult situations or sexual situations, but to use that as a warning label that an intimate scene between two men is somehow obscene and we need to warn our audiences, that's how far we've come. And now that this opera was received so rapturously here in Cincinnati and continues to be received with such open arms around the country, there's another production out there as well that's making the rounds. I've seen it happen. I see people's minds change. In all the opening nights I've seen, maybe one time I saw somebody get up and leave during the love scene in the first act. And every time I see it, I can't believe that I'm watching two men sing together and fall in love. Like how, especially opera is like one of the queerest, art forms in the world. And yet our stories are so underrepresented on stage. And so I'm so grateful to Tom Mallon for writing the novel and for Greg and Gregory and their tireless work to bring this story to the stage. And And I think you'll find that all of the historical aspects of the Lavender Scare in the piece are very well represented. The one scene that is an invention, and I think a brilliant invention, is when Hawk, the older character, is called in to the, I forget the name of the committee, but it's the name of the room, like MR 1615 or something. And he's called in and actually put through all the paces and asked to read to see if he has a lisp and to walk to see if he has a, you know, a swish in his step. And nobody really knows what happened in those rooms. So when you were called into these top secret government for being gay, you were asked questions, you were perhaps given a lie detector test. Nobody really knows what happened in those rooms. And Tom Mallon's invention of, or I guess invention is the wrong word, but his hypothesis of what might have happened, that scene is almost verbatim set by Greg and Gregory in the opera. And it's one of my favorite scenes because it's so heartbreaking, but also there's so many things that we don't know about what actually happened during this time. We're just starting to uncover all of this information, just like we're starting to really understand how Reagan and our government let us die by the hundreds of thousands and did nothing about it for years. And so, yes, our holding our government accountable for what they have done to our community and telling these stories and celebrating the people that survived these kind of traumatic and brutal events in our history to live to tell these stories is just one of the great honors of my life. I'm going to look at the chat here. I've seen it. Oh, I love this. Oh, good. Thank you for putting that in there. Don't you believe there were far more people impacted across the country as the Lavender Scare justified homophobia? Well, that is absolutely right. So, of course, it was. Yes, not only did it happen in Washington, but it was broadcast all over the news, right? Just like the AIDS crisis. When I grew up, all I saw on TV is that if you were gay, you were going to die. That's what I saw. And same thing in the 1950s. McCarthy, Roy Cohn on national television saying, we must get rid of all queer people. They didn't use that language then, of course. So they did not in the way that we've reappropriated it. But all homosexuals must be rooted out of government. They are toxic. I mean, look, it was in the psychiatric, you know, mental illness guidebook until like what, 1973? Is that the year? I don't have all my notes in front of me, but it was considered a mental illness, as many of us know. And so of course that permeated culture. That's such a great point, Byron, right? That everywhere in this country, it set back any kind of movement by decades, I think. And it was that kind of language, that shared trauma is something that we all still carry and that we're all working through as a community, that justification for homophobia coming from the center of our government. Yeah, it's really, really quite something. Anyway, that's a bit, I don't want to just talk, you know, and lecture you all. I'd love to see if anyone has any questions. And I'm a total open book, as you can probably tell. You can ask me anything you want about this piece, about my work. But I'm so honored to be here with all of you.
Kevin, I might ask you to just say a little bit about the reaction. Obviously, this idea of being not feeling safe to be out at the workplace for any number of reasons, although they may be different than they were in the 1950s, is still with us today. And when people come to this piece and learn of this era in our shared history, the kind of reaction that you see, I'll ask you to say something about that, but from my recollection, just seeing it in Chicago, not quite knowing what to expect, but being in a room full of people experiencing this story for the first time, learning about this historical moment, and coming to this sort of cathartic this catharsis sweeping over them as they hear this intimate story and this horrible historical chapter kind of unfold at the same time, really is life-changing and also very educational. Can you just speak a little bit about your experiences watching people watch this and learn about this and hear this story?
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about it all day. It's incredible. We always sit in the back of the theater and not only is the story so powerful, but the craftsmanship of how it's written, the way that Greg Spears and Greg Pierce's lyrics and music work together, it's Pavlovian. Like, I know exactly when you're going to laugh and I know when you're going to cry. It's really interesting. I mean, that's part of our job, of course. I mean, you think my job is to navigate and, you know, inspire a room full of people, millions, hopefully on television, right? To laugh and cry on cue and to share this story. And the architecture of this piece and the way that it works on your heart and soul as you're watching it, it gets me every single time. I mean, I'll warn you right now, Michael, when I'm there, right? When I get there at the dress rehearsal, I'm just going to start crying the minute it opens. And there's a moment where they first look at each other and they first see each other in the opening scene. And you know that they're going to fall in love and they're going to change each other's lives. And it's probably not going to end well. And as I said, every time we have a post-show discussion, almost everybody stays and people don't want to leave. And people are in tears and they are sharing their stories and you can see it at intermission. And I know that everyone goes out afterwards to restaurants or goes home and talks about it. I've gotten hundreds of emails and letters about how this piece has affected people, as our whole team has. And then everyone comes out also, not everyone, I shouldn't say that, but I think the majority of the audience comes out thinking and saying and sharing, I did not even know that this happened. How did I not know this, right? It's like the Tulsa massacre, like, you know, to talk about another social justice movement, like how are we not taught these things in school? I'm just reading Dave's comment here. Wow, I retired from the military in 2001. Unbelievable, Dave, thank you for sharing that. They were asked, are you a communist? Are you associated with an organization that could overthrow the government? And are you a homosexual? I mean, that's unbelievable, right? That actually stayed in our guidelines for that long. And yes, but to answer your question, it's changed my life. It really has, this opera. And I can't wait to take it all over the world. I think especially, like, it's great when we do it in like a city like New York, right? But when we start taking it around the country to cities like Des Moines and Cincinnati, we were in Arizona. And like when we're in New York City, most of the audience is on our team, let's be honest, right? when you're in the Prototype Festival in New York City, most people come in and their hearts and minds are open and they're ready. But to see it come to other communities where I keep coming back to the same thing, where I actually watch it change hearts and minds. I mean, when I sit in the back of the theater, again, you can see people shifting a little bit sometimes. And then by the end, everyone's catching their breath. So it's really, I'm so excited to see it in a couple of weeks. I feel I haven't seen it in since we were in Arizona.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I think we are coming close to the end of our time here, if I understand correctly, Byron. Do we have time for a question or two more? Do we need to move on?
If I could make just one quick statement. I think your statement about bridging the gaps between generations is really an important one. But one that points out that those of us who have lived through these situations need to tell our stories. Mm. You know, it points out to me how many young people, older people think that this is common knowledge because we lived it. But younger people don't understand what we lived through because we haven't told them. And until we do that and do that countrywide in every city, people won't understand why this is so important. And your statement of bridging those generations, I think, is an extremely important one. Thank you.
Oh, it is the one of the honors of my life to be able to do that. And I'm a storyteller, and I love hearing people's stories and sitting around the table with people from our community of different generations is absolutely one of my favorite things, whether it's on Fire Island or around a bar in Des Moines, wherever it happens. I think it's, again, we stand on your shoulders and hearing your stories, and we wouldn't be where we are now if it wasn't for everything that your generation went through. And if we don't learn from that and build upon it, then why are we here?
Thank you. Yeah, we need to move on and try to get to our scholarship presentation. Thank you so much for your presentation this morning. The impact of vilifying gay people is devastating to many families. It continues today.
Oh, it's
trans
my pleasure.
People now. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Okay, sorry. The impact of vilifying gay people is just devastating to families. That continues today as trans people have become the target of the radical right solely as to rally their base and further their political agenda. They don't really care that much about the very few little, you know, kids that want to go to sports. They just think it's a rallying point. And many gay people have their careers blunted because discrimination is so difficult to prove. So I think getting out there and anything like the opera, like television programs, anything that can reach more people will help us as people to understand each other. So moving forward, Randy Swores will now present the scholarship award.
Thank you, Byron. Good morning, everyone. I'm Dr. Randy Swartz, and I'm the chair of the FFB Scholarship Committee. Each year, members of the committee individually reads and scores all the scholarship applications. We then meet as a whole to come to agreement on the awardees. I'd like to thank the nominating committee for their hard work in selecting this year's scholarship recipients. The committee consists of Brett Burke, Ryan Crane, Ken Hansen, Byron Huff, Rick Miller, Tim Schreck, David Wolfert, Phil Williams, and myself. I also want to extend a special thank you to Tim Schreck in writing the biographies for this year's recipients. The FFB Scholarship was established in 1997 to recognize graduating high school seniors that have worked to reduce homophobia in their school and community. Since its founding, over $250,000 have been awarded. This year, we have 9 recipients, each receiving a $4,500 scholarship. This is a record in both number of recipients and the amount of the scholarship for any single year since FFB's inception. The scholarships are supported by many of our members and community allies. Of special note, scholarships have been sponsored in part or whole by the following individuals or organizations: the David and Trudy Hurd Trust, Polk County Betterment Grant, Orion Network Services, David A. Cotton, Jane Ann Cotton, the Cliff Paulson Bequest, and a couple that wish to remain anonymous. Now I'd like to ask all the students to open the packages that were sent to them and show us your award trophies while I read your biographies. This year's recipients: Moira Buey, Fort Dodge. Moira is a graduate of Fort Dodge Senior High School with plans to continue her education at Iowa State University. Reading Moira's application reminded us how meaningful acts of empathy and compassion can be in a person's life. Moira is an advocate, and even before fully understanding her identity as non-binary and queer, Moira was the person other queer friends would turn to. Moira is an activist and was inspired to take a lead in expanding on and strengthening the GSA at her school. Even though Moira only moved to Fort Dodge the beginning of her junior year, she soon realized she was the person who had to lead the GSA, implement structure, and create a much more safe and welcoming space for all students. Through writing and artistic research, Moira intends to continue to fight for all members of the queer community and to expose apathy if we ever think we've done enough. Congratulations, Moira. Leah Kaminsky. Leah Kaminsky, Mount Vernon High School. Leah began her application essays with the simple statement, "Everyone is born different." This question is, why do these differences take on so much negative meaning as we grow older? The question, the personal experiences, drive Leah's passion to eliminate all injustices and inequities. As a freshman at Mount Vernon High School, Leah joined the newly formed Social Justice Student Board, knowing that there was that there needed to be someone focused on LGBTQ community issues. Leah is a big, beautiful bisexual, and she has made it her mission to point out that her school's dress code was biased against girls, especially bigger girls. We had to acknowledge Leah for bringing her voice figuratively and literally to her advocacy. Leah is a multi-talented musician who will be attending the Berklee School of Music. Well done, Leah. Kian Cruz, Options Academy, Des Moines, Iowa. Kia has experienced some of the worst elements of homophobia and transphobia. Before their senior year, Kian was working through the stages of transitioning and decided he would become the first openly transgender student at his suburban high school. While he had open support from a couple teachers and some accommodation from administration, the student body response was quite different. It started with name calling and teasing, but eventually escalated to physical taunting, threats, and terror, simply for wanting to use a restroom. But Kian is a survivor, and though a family friend transferred, and through a family friend, transferred to Options Academy in Des Moines, Kian found a place to be himself, and he flourished. In 2019, Kian presented a Trans 101 talk at First Unitarian Church and later helped to organize a Trans Live Fest at the church, bringing in trans individuals from across the state for a day of sharing. Kian's application essays provided examples of how simply being oneself can change minds and attitudes in a group setting one-on-one. Congratulations, Kian. Maverick Myman, Boone High School. Maverick is an intelligent, wise, focused, and filled with empathy. And he's also a trans man. Maverick told his family he was trans in 2017 and was fortunate to receive acceptance, but a lot of questions. This helped Maverick to understand his need to be an educator by joining and eventually leading the small but mighty GSA group at Boone High School. A primary focus for the Boone GSA is safety, which can be so important in a primarily conservative town. Maverick joined the Iowa Safe Schools Student Leadership Council, helping to better define safe and rewarding student events across the state of Iowa. He was also a featured speaker at the 2019 Trans Summit sponsored by Safe Schools. In selecting Maverick as a scholarship recipient, we saw someone who was very fortunate to have a supportive coming out experience with most of his family, but who also understand that so many young people do not have that same experience. Maverick knows that being visible and using his voice is the best way to create acceptance for all members of the queer community. We hope you have an amazing college experience at the University of Iowa and in the years to come. Congratulations, Maverick. Emmeline Mitchell, East Union High School. Emmeline came out as gay in the eighth grade in a small Southwest Iowa town and immediately felt the scorn of her community. Family members rejected her, fellow students called her names and physically attacked her, and it got to the point that Emmeline did not know if she wanted to live through it. But as with all of our scholarship recipients, Emmeline rose above, which can be really hard to do in a school with a senior class of just 41 students. Emmeline knew she could not be the only queer person at her school, so she created a GSA, and students came for the simple opportunity of identifying others like themselves and having a community. Emmeline went on to become vice president of the Iowa Safe School Student Leadership Council. One of Emmeline's letters of recommendation called her a beacon of safety for other students, many of whom who identified Emmeline as a person who showed them it was okay to come out and be who they really are. Emmeline will attend Kirkwood Community College with plans to be a professional journalist. We look forward to your future stories, Emmeline. Congratulations. Grayson Pullen, East Sac High School. Grayson is the first transgender student to attend and graduate from East Sac County High School with a senior class population of 55 students. Grayson's story is one of tenacity and determination. He came out as transgender early and spent 4 years of high school facing challenges on every front. In his junior year, Grayson proposed starting a GSA at his school, but was denied that opportunity by administration forces. His senior year was spent in a learning environment outside the school building, where he continued to build awareness in his community that LGBTQ kids are everywhere, having conversations with several others in the school. Thanks to Grayson's supportive family, he is here to tell his story. His efforts have resulted in some teachers and counselors starting to understand the need for a safe place at East Sac High School. And we have to believe that comes from knowing and seeing Grayson for who he truly is. Grayson plans to attend Nasi College of Art in Tennessee with the hopes of becoming a professional photographer. Congratulations, Grayson. Michael Rosenberg, Hampton DeMont High School. Michael Rosenberg's story is another twist on a theme this year. Once again, we have a student from a small graduating class of 87 students. Michael has been openly gay for quite a while and lived his life openly while competing in cross country for over 4 years, participating in music and speech performance, and being very politically active. In his junior year, Michael led efforts to start a GSA at Hampton DeMont and had a group up and running well until the COVID breakout. What makes Michael special in his 2021 scholarship class is that he is also Jewish, which could be yet another outlier for a kid in a small Iowa town. And so this scholarship goes to Michael for living his life fully, but we also want to acknowledge his community for being open to diversity and acceptance for kids for who they are. Michael will be attending the University of Iowa with future plans to teach English. Congratulations, Michael. Lennon Shriver, Ogden High School. Lennon Shriver described the things he has done to fight homophobia as simple acts, but what a difference they have made. Lennon grew up in a very conservative household regarding the LGBT community, and so he needed to wait until his junior, senior years to fully come out as gay. Since then, he has led the charge for creating awareness and acceptance using one of his best assets, his speech and musical talents. Lennon organized a group of students to perform pieces in speech competition from the prom, a musical centered around two girls who want to attend prom together on a date. For his solo speech work, he chose selections from Falsettos, an earlier musical about gay men and love in the height of the AIDS crisis. Lennon is a leader, having been class president, a member of the student council, and a high profile athlete at Ogden High School. He was even student of the month this past January. And since coming out, he has become a touch point for other kids with questions about their sexuality or the coming out process. Lennon will be attending Wartburg College up in Waverly to pursue his music passions. And we look forward to hearing sweet sounds from him in the years to come. All the best, Lennon. Alyssa Cox, Louisa Muscatine High School. Alyssa came out in the seventh grade as bisexual in what could have been a classic Mean Girls event. But Alyssa was direct and true to herself and has been ever since. Alyssa's high school does not have a GSA or safe space, so Alyssa helped to create one. Initially, it was meant to be a space where she could take some breaths and keep marching through the day. Then other kids started showing up. While not an official GSA, this is a room where all are welcome and all are accepted. Alyssa is a leader and an achiever. What also impressed us were her two letters of recommendation coming from varsity coaches for basketball and softball who think the world of her and wish she could stay forever with their teams because she is a natural leader, true to herself and caring of others. We see good things in the future for Alyssa as she attends the University of Iowa with plans to become an attorney. Congratulations, Alyssa, and to all of this year's FFBC scholarship recipients. Thank you. And I'll turn it back over to Byron.
Okay, I think I got unmuted here. Oh, there. That was Alyssa, right? We didn't get you on the screen. Congratulations, Alyssa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. The presentation was amazing. The stories all amazing, and I was on the committee, and I'm just overwhelmed by the courage that these students have shown for this, and that's how this makes these scholarships very well deserved. If you notice, hit the chat button, you can see some links that have been posted by various people, and you can hit the dots. I think there's three little dots down at the bottom of the chat window, at least it is on mine. You can actually save that if you want to before you exit the meeting. So a reminder, save the day for the Opera Fellow Travelers on July 17th, go to GomeringMetroOpera.org. Upcoming speakers, August 6th will be Ian Lawrence Torrijo. Who is director of the BI Foundation and founder of AMBI Network, AMBI, a growing international collaborative of socially focused BI communities. As an activist, he is particularly interested in the role positive affirming support networks can serve as whole health and human rights intervention for BI people. In 2013, Ian created BI.org, which has grown to become the largest online resource of about bisexuality in the world. And I know we have maybe a couple speakers, but I don't have the information on them right now. We're getting those set up. And so make sure you're on our list, FFBC, go to ffbciowa.org and you should be able to see how to sign up for notifications and emails. And while we're hoping to get back, what we're working on the technology now to be in person and have the possibility of still live streaming via Zoom our presentations as we go to in-person meetings. So hopefully that will come up soon. Let's see, I think that's all I have for this morning. The meeting is officially adjourned. If you'd like to stay on the line and chat, you're more than welcome, but everyone have a wonderful, wonderful holiday weekend, 4th of July. Hopefully everyone can celebrate. Thank you. And again, congratulations to all our scholarship winners.
Byron,